You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Experts are saying that income inequality is at historic levels, and it's growing. It's estimated that the richest 10% holds 50% of the wealth in this country, and that the top 20% holds 84%. In a recent survey of Americans, Dan Ariely, James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University, and Michael Norton, a professor at the Harvard Business School, found that Americans drastically underestimate the level of income inequality. Their survey, Building a Better America, One Wealth Quintile at a Time, also reveals that we prefer a more equal distribution of wealth. Dan Ariely joined us this past April to discuss the survey and its findings and what they might mean for politics and policy reform. Many listeners responded to the segment, and we thought that we would air it again for you as we begin this celebration of the 4th of July. I began by asking Dan Ariely, what made you and Michael Norton want to look at what Americans think about the distribution of wealth in this country?
So it became clear to us that much of the discussion about elections and politics is really a discussion about what do we do with taxes. And much of the discussion was about what's efficient. So economists can argue about how much unemployment is actually needed for society and what is the right way to motivate people and so on, and what's the right level of taxes. And we wanted to take a step back and to say, you know, taxes are not just about efficiency. I mean, that's one thing that they're trying to provide. But the second thing they're trying to provide is a society that we're actually all happy to live in. So we said, what if we ask people, what kind of country would they want to live in? And that's basically what we did.
Well, wouldn't an anti-tax advocate see a political agenda to your research?
Well, you know, lots of people see agenda in everything we do. But I think that the way we phrase it, we try to be as objective as possible. And we said, you know, let's just see what people really, really want. And, you know, I'll tell you a lot. I mean, we got lots of objections, lots of people unhappy with all kinds of things. But they're unhappy because what the results showed. I don't think they're happy with the method. If the method would have showed something different, I don't think people would have been this unhappy.
And how did you conduct the survey? Did you have a broad selection of respondents?
Yes. So we hired a company that has a panel that is kind of representing Americans very broadly. And we had about 7,000 people in the sample from all level of income and social classes and genders and political opinions. And the first thing we asked them is, what do you think is the level of inequality? And we didn't use these terms. We say, how much of the wealth do you think the top 20% have, and the next 20%, and the next 20%, and the next, and the next? And basically, people got it wrong in a big way. They underestimated dramatically how much money the wealthy have, but they also overestimated dramatically how much money the poor have. So let me ask you, how much of the wealth do you think the bottom 40% of Americans own? From 100% in total, the bottom 40% of the people, how much do they have?
5%.
0.3.
0.3. Oh, yes. I overestimated it, and I was thinking small.
Yes. So it turns out the bottom 40% basically have nothing. And people, you overestimated by a lot, but most people estimate even more than you do. The average thinks that they own about 10%. So people dramatically don't understand how much the poor have and dramatically don't understand how much the wealthy have. That was the first thing. The second thing we did was we said, okay, so how do you want the income distribution to look like? And we went back and we looked at what John Rawls, the famous philosopher, said. And John Rawls had a really interesting definition. He said, a just society is a society that if you knew everything about it, you would be willing to enter it in a random place. And that kind of makes a lot of sense, right? Because if you're very wealthy, you want high income inequality. If you're very poor, you don't. But what if you don't know where you would be allocated in society? It's going to be a random draw. And you could be very wealthy. You could be in the middle. You could be among the very poor. And then we ask people, under those conditions in which you don't know what your fortune in life would look like, what society would you create that you would be happy to join? And basically, people created a society that was much more equal than what they thought the U.S. was. So the U.S. has a very high Gini coefficient. This is what how economists kind of measure the inequality. People thought the Gini coefficient in the U.S. was lower than it really is, but they wanted a society that is much more even than what we have now. And what was really actually the most optimistic part of this study, up to now everything is quite sad, but the optimistic part of this study is that when we looked at it by Republicans and Democrats, for example, we saw that the differences between them were not that big. So Republicans wanted slightly more income inequality and Democrats wanted slightly less income inequality, but the differences between them are not that big. If you look at where we are and where people in general want to be, that gap is tremendous. The differences between Republicans and Democrats, while there, it's actually quite small. So, for example, in one of the questions, we showed people two distributions of wealth. One was the distribution that was based on Sweden. We actually made it even more equal than Sweden. So we took a distribution that was more equal than Sweden, and the other one was a distribution based on the U.S. And we say, hey, you have these two countries. Which one would you rather choose to live in if you didn't know how wealthy you would be? And 92% of Americans chose the improved Swedish distribution.
Even the people who are in the top 2%?
Yeah. So when we looked at this by income, you know, we don't have that many people. It's a representative sample, so we don't have that many people in the top 2%, right? There are very few. But when we look at people who are wealthier and not wealthier, there are differences. The people who are wealthier prefer more income inequality. The people who are less wealthy prefer less. But the differences are not that big. So, for example, I said this number is 92% prefer the Swedish, what we call the Swedish distribution. For Republicans, it was 90.5%, and for Democrats, it was 93%. So, you know, you could say 93% versus 90.5%, that's a big difference. It's 2.5%, and it is a big difference, but it's tiny compared to the overall feeling, I think, of something here is really wrong in terms of the level of inequality that we have developed in this country.
Now, Dan, there's a full-page ad by an anti-tax organization in today's New York Times that says the top 2% pay 46% of taxes, and that's unfair. They make it sound like it's a disproportionate amount. But what you're saying is that is not unfair. How much of the wealth does the top 2% actually control? Should they be paying more than 46% of the taxes?
So first of all, you know, I'm kind of reporting studies about what people want, and you know, you can ask me for my personal opinion. We have actually, you know, some people that are upset with taxes said to us that our study was flawed because we didn't mention to people that more equality means higher taxes. So we just finished running another study in which we did this explicitly, and there was one group that we replicated the previous study, and there was another group that we said, you know, realize that if you decide a country that has more equality, it means more taxes. By the way, more equality doesn't necessarily mean more taxes. We can achieve more equality with education, with health. We can also achieve it with taxes. But taxes is one way. It's not the only way. But anyway, so we asked people about this. And again, we didn't find a big difference. So I don't think it's kind of people's aversion to taxes. On the other hand, we tried one more thing. We told some people to imagine a country that has a very low social mobility. So if you're poor, you always stay poor. If you're rich, you always stay rich. And to other people, we asked them to imagine a country that has a very high social mobility, that it's up to you where you move to in society. And what happened is that when social mobility was very high, people are willing to tolerate much higher levels of inequality. And I think what you see in politics, so you see in the political arena out there, the people who want to keep taxes low are the people who are making a lot of money, right? I mean, it's basically they're self-interested.
Which turns out to be just 7% of Americans, according to your survey. I guess they're all in Congress.
No, remember, in our survey, one of the differences was we kind of stripped people from their current wealth. Right? We say, imagine you're going to a new society and you have to decide how wealthy it is. We didn't remind them how wealthy they are. And I actually believe that even if you took very wealthy people, excuse me, and you ask them about their deep down beliefs about income inequality, they would not be as extreme as they are. But when you look at the reality, and we just finished tax day, and you see how much money you pay in taxes, you say, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I paid less? So we have these selfish motives that are driving us to behave in a selfish way. And if you ask the question in a selfish way, people would give you the selfish answer. I think what we were able to do in this study is to strip away kind of the rhetorics of politics and strip away selfishness and ask people, okay, deep down, what do you believe would make a society that you want to join? Now, doesn't mean to say that after looking at our study or even after answering, the people who took this would go and say, let me now start contributing more to charity or let me start contributing more to taxes. I think the question of what people believe deep down and what are the barriers that politics create between beliefs and actions are actually the two different, very different stories.
My guest is Dan Ariely from the Department of Psychology at Duke University. He and Michael I. Norton of the Harvard Business School put together a study that they've called Building a Better America, One Wealth Quintile at a Time. You've been suggesting, I guess, that in the conversation about the distribution of wealth and what's fair, we're being influenced by what politicians say. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that politics, again, if you look at the results and you say, how come Republicans and Democrats in our study are so similar to each other? I think the conclusion that I'm drawing is that politics is actually obscuring people's deep down values. We basically pollute people with all kinds of words and terminology and what they can have slogans and not think about the deep down aspect of what country would you want to live in that would actually make you proud and happy to live in. And people talk about death taxes, and they talk about the Milton Friedman ideology and individualism, and this country was founded on fighting against taxes and small government.
And really, class warfare is a major label that they also apply to this kind of discussion.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that actually it takes us away from kind of the question of which society do we actually want to live in. What is the, you know, income inequality creates, there's lots of injustice, there's lots of problems, there's a lot of potential poverty, and what kind of country would you really like to live in? There's actually something interesting Bob Frank from Cornell has been making an argument about how much do you believe that your outcome in life is a function of luck and how much of it is a function of skill. So if you had to take 100% and divide it between luck and skill, how much would you say your success has been luck versus skill?
You're going to ask me?
Yeah.
Luck has played a major role in my life and my career. People called me at times when I was not doing well and offered me jobs or opportunities and changed my life. So I would say luck has played a part, but then I had to have the skills to be able to handle the jobs once I had them.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is really kind of an interesting question. And if you actually met a really good poker player recently, and she told me that before she became a very accomplished poker player, she thought that life was 90% skill and 10% luck. And now that she plays poker, she thinks that life is 95% luck and 5% skill.
The hand that you're dealt.
That's right. But she says that 5% is a lot because mm-hmm. you're playing so many hands, it would really matter over a long time.
But you mentioned earlier mobility. This is tied to that whole idea that anybody in America can become president. But it's obviously not true.
It is obviously not true. I'm not sure, you know, exactly what the mobility in the U.S. is, but I think the belief in high mobility and the belief in our own skill, I think they're connected, right? So if you believe that it's all about you and it's you, then, you know, if you decide to be poor, it's your decision. If you decide to be wealthy, it's your decision. So I think the combination of social mobility and the idea that it's about skill and not about luck is basically blocking people from creating, from taking any actions against the large inequality that we have. We look at these people who are very wealthy, and we say, oh, you know, they just must be really good. And everybody could do this, and I could do it one day, and my kids could do it that way. So it's both the skill and the ability in social mobility that I think is not getting people to be angrier and do something more about this inequality. And what Bob Frank is saying, that if you start believing more in luck, you should also start believing more that people should pay higher taxes at the top brackets, because all of a sudden it's not just a tribute to your ability, it's attributed to luck as well. And why should you benefit from luck rather than lots of people in society?
I mean, somebody who's born rich, even if they become richer, like Donald Trump, he still was born with a lot more money than somebody else who was comes from a different part of Queens.
That's right.
Has this income inequality been a part of American life for a long time?
So the income inequality have increased dramatically over the past couple of decades, and it's also changing in terms of who are the people who are becoming more and more wealthy. So it used to be that it was the people who had family fortunes, the Rockefellers, right, that kept on becoming, staying wealthy, and it basically has moved toward banking. And now that we pay bankers so much, the income inequality goes not to the people who have historical wealth or family wealth; it goes to the people in the financial sector. So that has changed dramatically from what kind of people are getting wealthier and wealthier.
The current budget proposal passed by the House calls for big cuts to social services and programs for the disadvantaged, while keeping the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. But that doesn't seem to reflect the feelings of the people who responded to your survey.
That's right. And I think that if you only explain to people what the vote is about, I think they would be appalled. You know, when the first Bush tax was passed, I was teaching at MIT, and my assistant at the time, who was an avid Republican, was going to be one of the people who was going to suffer the most from the Bush tax cut, because this tax cut initially gave a small tax cut to everybody, but over time it gave bigger and bigger tax cuts to people who are wealthier and wealthier, and actually just increasing the income inequality, right? Over 10 years it was a gradual change. And when I talked to her about this tax cut, she couldn't even talk to me about the logic of anything on it. She basically equated the word tax with the devil, and with her notion it was also connected to being pro-choice, which she didn't like either. And there was no ability to have an intellectual discussion about what taxes are actually used for and what they mean and what they mean for her. And you know, you see in the U.S. lots and lots of people who are voting against what seem to be their best interest, their best selfish interest. And I think part of it is that we have had an ideology in this country that equates taxes to something immoral and something bad. And I'm not sure where it's coming from, by the way. This kind of baffles me. So I didn't grow up in the States.
But you grew up in another country where taxes are very high. Isn't this an issue there?
That's right. So there's a few things. So I grew up in Israel where taxes are very high, and of course the military expenses are also incredibly high, and everybody understands it. And nobody likes paying taxes, of course. You know, everybody would prefer to keep more of their money. But there are a few interesting things that are different about the U.S. and Israel. One thing in the U.S., there's a tax day, right? So you get your income, and all of a sudden the government, you see how much the government is taking from it. Whereas in other countries, in most countries, there is no tax day. There's not so many deductions possible. And basically your employer holds the right amount of tax, and you just see your net income. And that, I think, has some real advantages because, you know, in this country, you know how much you paid on a yearly basis, but you really don't know what your take-home income is. And you can imagine, let's say your gross salary that you're getting is $80,000. You think to yourself that you're making $80,000. Only on April 15th of the year following that, you realize that you really haven't made $80,000. And by that time, you feel, A, it's your money. It was never the government's money. And B, you feel all of a sudden poor. If we just deducted originally the amount of money from your paycheck and you never felt it was yours, I think things would have been very different. But also the tax code in the U.S. is so complex and so annoying. Then rather than thinking about this as a day in which you're contributing to society and you think about what you're getting from taxes and what you're not, it becomes an exercise in frustration and annoyance to figure out what's deductible and what's not and what's acceptable and what's not. So I think the tax code that has developed over the years as a way to, I think, try to incentivize small businesses and try to create lots of loopholes for big businesses has made the process much less interesting, much more annoying.
So, Professor Ariely, what are the long-term effects of the level of inequality we're currently having in this country? Is it what does it mean for us? Is it bad for our society?
So I think that it means that we're going to create different societies in this country. I think that the idea of that there's really already not a single America, right? If you think about who goes to the military and who goes to Wall Street, those are very different type of people. Who work in factories and who go to universities. We're already kind of moving into a world in which the class differences are really quite dramatic. And these are self-reinforcing differences, right? So Harvard is a small university. It's only going to take a few people. Who are they going to take? Most likely they're going to take a smaller and smaller part of a larger, wealthier number of people. Right. So if right now, I'm just making this up, but if right now there are people in Harvard from the top 30% of the U.S., maybe over time it will be the top 0.5%. And we will basically just create this separate society. And what you do in those cases is that there's all not a single ideology. And since we all live in a democratic country and we all vote, what happens is that the wealthy have to invest in all kinds of things like lobbying and basically create other distortions to keep the structure going. And I think it's just creating lots and lots of devastation.
Well, some of the countries that have better income distribution than the United States are predictable. You mentioned Sweden, Great Britain, France, Germany. They have their own problems. Some of the bigger surprises are Guyana, Nicaragua, Venezuela.
Yeah.
They have less wealth inequality than we do. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, Chile. I mean, you can think about there's a lot of countries. And, you know, I don't think you can take the problems and success of each particular country and attribute it to wealth inequality. I also don't think we should have zero wealth inequality. But if you ask whether the top 1% of if 1% of Americans should get 25% of the income, right? That just doesn't seem like it fits with a country that has a common goal. And we have lots of common goal. We have common goals in terms of security. We have common goals in terms of health. We have common goals in terms of economic development. If nothing else, the 2007-2008 economic recession have taught us how much we all live together and can influence and suffer.
Well, I have one more question for you. The,
yeah.
The survey was published by the journal Perspectives on Psychological Science. So is this a topic that's more about psychology than about economics?
I think that psychology and economics are very tightly related. But I think that the angle that we took, which is about what people think this should be, is more about psychology. You could create arguments about what is more efficient, and this will be more economic arguments. But I think it's the end solution will have to come up from both psychology and economics.
Dan Ariely is James B. Duke Professor of Behavioral Economics at Duke University. Michael Norton is a professor at the Harvard Business School, and together they have put together a survey called Building a Better America, One Wealth Quintile at a Time. Thank you so much for talking with us again, Dan.
My pleasure.